I think that Harold Obolowski's call in October of 1997 was what kicked off the dreams. Harold's ostensible reason for calling was to congratulate me on the impending release of Darcy's Admirer, which was entertaining as hell and which also contained some extremely thought-provoking shit. I suspected he had at least one other item on his agenda, Harold usually does, and I was right. He'd had lunch with Deborah Weinstock, my editor, the day before, and they had gotten talking about the fall of 1998. "Looks crowded," he said, meaning the fall lists, meaning specifically the fiction half of the fall lists. "And there are some surprise additions. Dean Koontz." "I thought he usually published in January," I said. "He does, but Deborah hears this one may be delayed. He wants to add a section or something. Also, there's a Harold Robbins, The Predators. Big deal." "Robbins still has his fans, Mike. Still has his fans. As you yourself have pointed out on more than one occasion, fiction writers have a long arc." "Uh-huh." I switched the telephone to the other ear and leaned back in my chair. I caught a glimpse of the framed Sarah Laff's photo over my desk when I did. I would be visiting it at greater length and proximity that night in my dreams, although I didn't know that then. All I knew then was that I wished like almighty fuck that Harold Obolowski would hurry up and get to the point. "I sense impatience, Michael, my boy," Harold said. "Did I catch you at your desk? Are you writing?" "Just finished for the day," I said. "I'm thinking about lunch, however." "I'll be quick," he promised. "But hang with me. This is important. There may be as many as 5 other writers we didn't expect publishing next fall. Ken Follett, it's supposed to be his best since Eye of the Needle. Belva Plaine, John Jakes." "None of those guys play tennis on my court," I said, although I knew that was not exactly Harold's point. Harold's point was that there are only 15 slots on the Times list. "How about Jean Owl finally publishing the next of her Sex Among the Cave People epics?" I sat up. "Jean Owl? Really?" "Well, not 100%, but it looks good. Last but not least is a new Mary Higgins Clark. I know what tennis court she plays on, and so do you." If I'd gotten that sort of news 6 or 7 years earlier, when I'd felt I had a great deal more to protect, I would have been frothing. Mary Higgins Clark did play on the same court, shared exactly the same audience, and so far our publishing schedules had been arranged to keep us out of each other's way, which was to my benefit rather than hers, let me assure you. Going nose to nose, she would cream me. As the late Jim Croce so wisely observed, "You don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull the mask off that old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Mary Higgins Clark. Not if you're Michael Noonan, anyway." "How did this happen?" I asked. I don't think my voice was particularly ominous, but Harold replied in the nervous, stumbling all over his own words fashion of a man who suspects he may be fired or even beheaded for bearing evil tidings. "I don't know. She just happened to get an extra idea this year, I guess. That does happen, I'd been told." As a fellow who had taken his share of double dips, I knew it did. So I simply asked Harold what he wanted. It seemed the quickest and easiest way to get him to relinquish the phone. The answer was no surprise. What he and Deborah both wanted, not to mention all the rest of my Putnam pals, was a book they could publish in late summer of 98. Thus getting in front of Ms. Clark and the rest of the competition by a couple of months. Then, in November, the Putnam sales reps would give the novel a healthy second push with the Christmas season in mind. "So they say," I replied. Like most novelists, and in this regard the successful are no different from the unsuccessful, indicating there might be some merit to the idea as well as the usual free-floating paranoia, I never trusted publishers' promises. "I think you can believe them on this, Mike. Darcy's Admirer was the last book of your old contract, remember?" Harold sounded almost sprightly at the thought of forthcoming contract negotiations with Deborah Weinstock and Phyllis Gran at Putnam. "The big thing is they still like you. They'd like you even more, I think, if they saw pages with your name on them before Thanksgiving." They want me to give them the next book in November? Next month? I injected what I hoped was the right note of incredulity into my voice, just as if I hadn't had Helen's promise in a safety deposit box for almost 11 years. It had been the first nut I had stored. It was now the only nut I had left. "No, no, you could have until January 15th at least," he said, trying to sound magnanimous. I found myself wondering where he and Deborah had gotten their lunch. Some fly place. I would have bet my life on that. Maybe the Four Seasons. Joanna always used to call that place Frankie Valley in the Four Seasons. It means they'd have to crash production, seriously crash it, but they're willing to do that. The real question is whether or not you could crash production. I think I could, but it'll cost them, I said. Tell them to think of it as being like same-day service on your dry cleaning. Oh, what a rotten shame for them. Harold sounded as if he were maybe jacking off and had reached the point where Old Faithful splurts and everybody snaps their Instamatics. How much do you think? A surcharge tacked onto the advance is probably the way to go, he said. They'll get pouty, of course, claim that the move is in your interest, too, primarily in your interest, even. But based on the extra work argument, the midnight oil you'll have to burn, the mental agony of creation, the pangs of premature birth. Right. Yeah, right. I think a 10% surcharge sounds about right. He spoke judiciously, like a man trying to be just as damn fair as he possibly could. Myself, I was wondering how many women would induce birth a month or so early if they got paid $200,000 or $300,000 extra for doing so. Probably some questions are best left unanswered. And in my case, what difference did it make? The goddamn thing was written, wasn't it? Well, see if you can make the deal, I said. Yeah, but I don't think we want to be talking about just a single book here, okay? I think, Harold, what I want right now is to eat some lunch. You sound a little tense, Michael. Is everything? Everything is fine. Talk to them about just one book with a sweetener for speeding up production at my end, okay? Okay, he said after one of his most significant pauses, but I hope this doesn't mean you won't entertain a 3 or 4 book contract later on. Make hay while the sun shines, remember. It's the motto of champions. Cross each bridge when you come to it is the motto of champions, I said. And that night I dreamt I went to Sarah Lapp's again. In that dream, in all the dreams I had that fall and winter, I am walking up the lane to the lodge. The lane is a 2-mile loop through the woods with ends opening onto Route 68. It has a number at either end, Lane 42 if it matters, in case you have to call in a fire, but no name. Nor did Joe and I ever give it one, not even between ourselves. It is narrow, really just a double rut with timothy and witchgrass growing on the crown. When you drive in, you can hear that grass whispering like low voices against the undercarriage of your car or truck. I don't drive in the dream, though. I never drive. In these dreams, I walk. The trees huddle in close at either side of the lane. The darkening sky overhead is little more than a slot. Soon I will be able to see the first peeping stars. Sunset is past. Crickets chirr. Loons cry on the lake. Small things, chipmunks probably, or the occasional squirrel, rustle in the woods. Now I come to a dirt driveway sloping down the hill on my right. It is our driveway, marked with a little wooden sign which reads, Sarah Laughs. I stand at the head of it, but I don't go down. Below is the lodge. It's all logs and added-on wings, with a deck jutting out behind. 14 rooms in all, a ridiculous number of rooms. It should look ugly and awkward, but somehow it does not. There is a brave dowager quality to Sarah, the look of a lady pressing resolutely on toward her 100th year, still taking pretty good strides in spite of her arthritic hips and gimpy old knees. The central section is the oldest, dating back to 1900 or so. Other sections were added in the 30s, 40s, and 60s. Once it was a hunting lodge. For a brief period in the early 70s, it was home to a small commune of transcendental hippies. These were lease or rental deals. The owners from the late 40s until 1984 were the Hingermans, Darren and Marie. Then Marie alone when Darren died in 1971. The only visible addition from our period of ownership is the tiny DSS dish mounted on the central roof peak. That was Joanna's idea, and she never really got a chance to enjoy it. Beyond the house, the lake glimmers in the afterglow of sunset. The driveway I see is carpeted with brown pine needles and littered with fallen branches. The bushes which grow on either side of it have run wild, reaching out to one another like lovers across the narrowed gap which separates them. If you brought a car down here, the branches would scrape and squeal unpleasantly against its sides. Below, I see, there's moss growing on the logs of the main house, and three large sunflowers with faces like searchlights have grown up through the boards of the little driveway side stoop. The overall feeling is not neglect exactly, but forgottenness. There is a breath of breeze, and its coldness on my skin makes me realize that I have been sweating. I can smell pine, a smell which is both sour and clean at the same time, and the faint but somehow tremendous smell of the lake. Darkscore is one of the cleanest, deepest lakes in Maine. It was bigger until the late 30s, Marie Hingerman told us. That was when Western Maine Electric, working hand in hand with the mills and paper operations around Rumford, had gotten state approval to dam the Jessa River. Marie also showed us some charming photographs of white-frocked ladies and vested gentlemen in canoes. These snaps were from the time of the First World War, she said, and pointed to one of the young women, frozen forever on the rim of the Jazz Age with a dripping paddle upraised. That's my mother, she said, and the man she's threatening with the paddle is my father. Loons crying, their voices like loss. Now I can see Venus in the darkening sky. Star light, star bright, wish I may, wish I might. In these dreams I always wish for Joanna. With my wish made, I try to walk down the driveway. Of course I do. It's my house, isn't it? Where else would I go but my house, now that it's getting dark, and now that the stealthy rustling in the woods seems both closer and somehow more purposeful? Where else can I go? It's dark, and it will be frightening to go into that dark place alone. Suppose Sarah resents having been left so long alone. Suppose she's angry. But I must. If the electricity's off, I'll light one of the hurricane lamps we keep in a kitchen cabinet. Except, I can't go down. My legs won't move. It's as if my body knows something about the house down there that my brain does not. The breeze rises again, chilling goose flesh out onto my skin, and I wonder what I have done to get myself all sweating like this. Have I been running? And if so, what have I been running toward? Or from? My hair is sweaty, too. It lies on my brow in an unpleasantly heavy clump. I raise my hand to brush it away and see there is a shallow cut, fairly recent, running across the back just beyond the knuckles. Sometimes this cut is on my right hand, sometimes it's on the left. I think, if this is a dream, the details are good. Always that same thought. If this is a dream, the details are good. It's the absolute truth. They are a novelist's details. But in dreams, perhaps everyone is a novelist. How is one to know? Now Sarah laughs is only a dark hulk down below, and I realize I don't want to go down there anyway. I am a man who has trained his mind to misbehave, and I can imagine too many things waiting for me inside. A rabid raccoon crouched in a corner of the kitchen. Bats in the bathroom. If disturbed, they'll crowd the air around my cringing face, squeaking and fluttering my cheeks with their dusty wings. even one of William Denbrough's famous creatures from beyond the universe, now hiding under the porch and watching me approach with glittering, pus-rimmed eyes. "Well, I can't stay up here," I say, "but my legs won't move, and it seems I will be staying up here where the driveway meets the lane, that I will be staying up here, like it or not." Now the rustling in the woods behind me sounds not like small animals. Most of them would by then be nested or burrowed for the night anyway, but approaching footsteps. I try to turn and see, but I can't even do that. And that was where I usually woke up. The first thing I always did was to turn over, establishing my return to reality by demonstrating to myself that my body would once more obey my mind. Sometimes, most times actually, I would find myself thinking, "Manderley, I have dreamt again of Manderley." There was something creepy about this. There's something creepy about any repeating dream, I think, about knowing your subconscious is digging obsessively at some object that won't be dislodged. But I would be lying if I didn't add that some part of me enjoyed the breathless summer calm in which the dream always wrapped me, and that part also enjoyed the sadness and foreboding I felt when I awoke. There was an exotic strangeness to the dream that was missing from my waking life, now that the road leading out of my imagination was so effectively blocked. The only time I remember being really frightened, and I must tell you I don't completely trust any of these memories, because for so long they didn't seem to exist at all, was when I awoke one night speaking quite clearly into the dark of my bedroom. "Something's behind me. Don't let it get me. Something in the woods. Please don't let it get me." It wasn't the words themselves that frightened me so much as the tone in which they were spoken. It was the voice of a man on the raw edge of panic, and hardly seemed like my own voice at all. 2 days before Christmas of 1997, I once more drove down to Fidelity Union, where once more the bank manager escorted me to my safety deposit box in the fluorescent-lit catacombs. As we walked down the stairs, he assured me, for the dozenth time at least, that his wife was a huge fan of my work. She'd read all my books, couldn't get enough. For the dozenth time, at least, I replied that now I must get him in my clutches. He responded with his usual chuckle. I thought of this oft-repeated exchange as banker's communion. Mr. Quinlan inserted his key in slot A and turned it. Then, as discreetly as a pimp who has conveyed a customer to a whore's crib, he left. I inserted my own key in slot B, turned it, and opened the drawer. It looked very vast now. The one remaining manuscript box seemed almost to quail in the far corner, like an abandoned puppy who somehow knows his sibs have been taken off and gassed. "Promise" was scrawled across the top in fat black letters. I could barely remember what the goddamn story was about. I snatched that time traveler from the 80s and slammed the safe deposit box shut. Nothing left in there now but dust. "Give me that," Joe had hissed in my dream. It was the first time I'd thought of that one in years. "Give me that. It's my dust catcher." "Mr. Quinlan, I'm finished," I called. My voice sounded rough and unsteady to my own ears, but Quinlan seemed to sense nothing wrong, or perhaps he was just being discreet. I can't have been the only customer, after all, who found his or her visits to this financial version of Forest Lawn emotionally distressful. "I'm really going to read one of your books," he said, dropping an involuntary little glance at the box I was holding. I suppose I could have brought a briefcase to put it in, but on those expeditions I never did. "In fact, I think I'll put it on my list of New Year's resolutions." "You do that," I said. "You just do that, Mr. Quinlan." "Mark," he said, "please." He'd said this before, too. I had composed two letters which I slipped into the manuscript box before setting out for Federal Express. Both had been written on my computer, which my body would let me use as long as I chose the notepad function. It was only opening Word 6 that caused the storms to start. I never tried to compose a novel using the notepad function, understanding that if I did, I'd likely lose that option too, not to mention my ability to play Scrabble and do crosswords on the machine. I had tried a couple of times to compose longhand with spectacular lack of success. The problem wasn't what I had once heard described as screen shyness. I had proved that to myself. One of the notes was to Harold, the other to Deborah Weinstock, and both said pretty much the same thing. Here's the new book, Helen's Promise. Hope you like it as much as I do. If it seems a little rough, it's because I had to work a lot of extra hours to finish it this soon. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Aaron go bra. Trick or treat. Hope someone gives you a fucking pony. I stood for almost an hour in a line of shuffling, bitter-eyed late mailers. Christmas is such a carefree, low-pressure time. That's one of the things I love about it. With Helen's Promise under my left arm and a paperback copy of Nelson DeMille's The Charm School in my right hand, I read almost 50 pages before entrusting my final unpublished novel to a harried-looking clerk. When I wished her a Merry Christmas, she shuddered and said nothing. The phone was ringing when I walked in my front door. It was Frank Arlen asking me if I'd like to join him for Christmas. Join them, as a matter of fact. All his brothers and their families were coming. I opened my mouth to say no. The last thing on earth I needed was a crazed Irish Christmas with everybody drinking whiskey and waxing sentimental about Joe while perhaps 24 snot-caked rugrats crawled around the floor, and heard myself saying I'd come. Frank sounded as surprised as I felt, but honestly delighted. Fantastic, he cried. When can you get here? I was in the hall, my galoshes dripping on the tile, and from where I was standing I could look through the arch and into the living room. There was no Christmas tree. I hadn't bothered with one since Joe died. The room looked both ghastly and much too big to me, a roller rink furnished in early American. I've been out running errands, I said. How about I throw some underwear in a bag, get back into the car, and come south while the heater's still blowing warm air? Tremendous, Frank said without a moment's hesitation. We can have us a sane bachelor evening before the sons and daughters of East Malden start arriving. I'm pouring you a drink as soon as I get off the telephone. Then I guess I'd better get rolling, I said. That was hands down the best holiday since Joanna died. The only good holiday, I guess. For 4 days, I was an honorary Arlen. I drank too much, toasted Joanna's memory too many times, and knew, somehow, that she'd be pleased to know I was doing it. Two babies spit up on me, one dog got into bed with me in the middle of the night, and Nikki Arlen's sister-in-law made a bleary pass at me on the night after Christmas when she caught me alone in the kitchen making a turkey sandwich. I kissed her because she clearly wanted to be kissed, and an adventurous, or perhaps mischievous is the word I want, hand groped me for a moment in a place where no one other than myself had groped in almost 3.5 years. It was a shock, but not an entirely unpleasant one. It went no further. In a house full of Arlens and with Susie Donahue not quite officially divorced yet, like me, she was an honorary Arlen that Christmas. It hardly could have done, but I decided it was time to leave. Unless, that was, I wanted to go driving at high speed down a narrow street that most likely ended in a brick wall. I left on the 27th, very glad that I had come, and I gave Frank a fierce goodbye hug as we stood by my car. For 4 days, I hadn't thought at all about how there was now only dust in my safety deposit box at Fidelity Union. And for 4 nights I had slept straight through until 8 in the morning, sometimes waking up with a sour stomach and a hangover headache, but never once in the middle of the night with the thought, Manderley, I have dreamt again of Manderley, going through my mind. I got back to Derry feeling refreshed and renewed. The first day of 1998 dawned clear and cold and still and beautiful. I got up, showered, then stood at the bedroom window drinking coffee. It suddenly occurred to me, with all the simple, powerful reality of ideas like up is over your head and down is under your feet, that I could write now. It was a new year, something had changed, and I could write now if I wanted to. The rock had rolled away. I went into the study, sat down at the computer, and turned it on. My heart was beating normally. There was no sweat on my forehead or the back of my neck, and my hands were warm. I pulled down the main menu, the one you get when you click on the Apple, and there was my old pal Word 6. I clicked on it. The pen and parchment logo came up, and when it did, I suddenly couldn't breathe. It was as if iron bands had been clamped around my chest. I pushed back from the desk, gagging and clawing at the round neck of the sweatshirt I was wearing. The wheels of my office chair caught on a little throw rug, one of Joe's finds in the last year of her life, and I tipped right over backward. The back of my head banged the floor, and I saw a fountain of bright sparks go whizzing across my field of vision. I suppose I was lucky not to black out, but I think my real luck on New Year's morning of 1998 was that I tipped over the way I did. If I'd only pushed back from the desk so that I was still looking at the logo and at the hideous blank screen which followed it, I think I might have choked to death. When I staggered to my feet, I was at least able to breathe. My throat felt the size of a straw, and each inhale made a weird screaming sound, but I was breathing. I lurched into the bathroom and threw up in the basin with such force that vomit splashed the mirror. I grayed out and my knees buckled. This time it was my brow I struck, funking it against the lip of the basin, and although the back of my head didn't bleed, there was a very respectable lump there by noon, though, my forehead did, a little. It also left a hell of a bruise, which I, of course, lied about, telling folks who asked that I'd run into the bathroom door in the middle of the night. Silly me, that'll teach a fella to get up at 2 a.m. without turning on a lamp. When I regained complete consciousness, if there is such a state, I was curled on the floor. I got up, disinfected the cut on my forehead, and sat on the lip of the tub with my head lowered to my knees until I felt confident enough to stand up. I sat there for 15 minutes, I guess, and in that space of time I decided that, barring some miracle, my career was over. Harold would scream in pain, and Deborah would moan in disbelief, but what could they do? Send out the publication police? Threaten me with the Book of the Month Club Gestapo? Even if they could, what difference would it make? You couldn't get sap out of a brick or blood out of a stone. Barring some miraculous recovery, my life as a writer was over. And if it is, I asked myself, what's on the back 40, Mike? You can play a lot of Scrabble in 40 years, go on a lot of crossword cruises, drink a lot of whiskey. But is that enough? What else are you going to put on your back 40? I didn't want to think about that, not then. The next 40 years could take care of themselves. I would be happy just to get through New Year's Day of 1998. When I felt I had myself under control, I went back into my study, shuffled to the computer with my eyes resolutely on my feet, felt around for the right button, and turned off the machine. You can damage the program shutting down like that without putting it away, but under the circumstances, I hardly thought it mattered. That night, I once again dreamed I was walking at twilight on Lane 42, which leads to Sarah Laughs. Once more I wished on the evening star as the loons cried on the lake, and once more I sensed something in the woods behind me, edging ever closer. It seemed my Christmas holiday was over. That was a hard, cold winter, lots of snow, and in February a flu epidemic that did for an awful lot of Derry's old folks. It took them the way a hard wind will take old trees after an ice storm. It missed me completely. I hadn't as much as a case of the sniffles that winter. In March, I flew to Providence and took part in Will Weng's New England Crossword Challenge. I placed fourth and won $50. I framed the uncashed check and hung it in the living room. Once upon a time, most of my framed certificates of triumph, Joe's phrase, all the good phrases are Joe's phrases, it seems to me, went up on my office walls. But by March of 1998, I wasn't going in there very much. When I wanted to play Scrabble against the computer or do a turning-level crossword puzzle, I used the power book and sat at the kitchen table. I remember sitting there one day, opening the power book's main menu, going down to the crossword puzzles, then dropping the cursor two or three items further, until it had highlighted my old pal, Word 6. What swept over me then wasn't frustration or impotent, balked fury. I'd experienced a lot of both since finishing all the way from the top. But sadness and simple longing. Looking at the Word 6 icon was suddenly like looking at one of the pictures of Joe I kept in my wallet. Looking at them, I'd sometimes think that I would sell my immortal soul in order to have her back again. And on that day in March, I thought I would sell my soul to be able to write a story again. "Go on and try it, then," a voice whispered. "Maybe things have changed." Except that nothing had changed, and I knew it. So instead of opening Word 6, I moved it across to the trash barrel in the lower right-hand corner of the screen and dropped it in. "Goodbye, old pal." Deborah Weinstock called a lot that winter, mostly with good news. Helen's Promise had been picked as one half of the Literary Guild's main selection for August, the other half being a legal thriller by Steve Martini, another veteran of the 8-15 segment of the Times bestseller list. And my British publisher, Deborah said, loved Helen, was sure it would be my breakthrough book. My British sales had always lagged. "Promise is sort of a new direction for you," Deborah said. "Wouldn't you say?" I kind of thought it was, I confessed, and wondered how Debbie would respond if I told her my new direction book had been written almost a dozen years ago. "It's got, I don't know, a kind of maturity." "Thanks." "Mike, I think the connection's going. You sound muffled." "Sure I did. I was biting down on the side of my hand to keep from howling with laughter. Now, cautiously, I took it out of my mouth and examined the bite marks." "Better?" "Yes, lots. So what's the new one about? Give me a hint." "You know the answer to that one, kiddo." Deborah laughed. "You'll have to read the book to find out, Josephine," she said. "Right?" "Yes'm." "Well, keep it coming. Your pals at Putnam's are crazy about the way you're taking it to the next level." I said goodbye. I hung up the telephone, and then I laughed wildly for about 10 minutes. Laughed until I was crying. That's me, though, always taking it to the next level. During this period, I also agreed to do a phone interview with a Newsweek writer who was putting together a piece on the New American Gothic, whatever that was, other than a phrase that might sell a few magazines, and to sit for a Publisher's Weekly interview which would appear just before the publication of Helen's Promise. I agreed to these because they both sounded softball, the sort of interviews you could do over the phone while you read your mail. And Deborah was delighted because I ordinarily say no to all the publicity. I hate that part of the job and always have, especially the hell of the 5 p.m. live TV chat show where nobody's ever read your goddamn book and the first question is always, "Where in the world do you get those wacky ideas?" The publicity process is like going to a sushi bar where you're the sushi. And it was great to get past it this time with the feeling that I'd been able to give Deborah some good news she could take to her bosses. "Yes," she could say, "he's still being a booger about publicity, but I got him to do a couple of things." All through this, my dreams of Sarah Laughs were going on. Not every night, but every second or third night, with me never thinking of them in the daytime. I did my crosswords. I bought myself an acoustic steel guitar and started learning how to play it. I was never going to be invited to tour with Patti Loveless or Alan Jackson, however. I scanned each day's bloated obituaries in the Derry News for names that I knew. I was pretty much dozing on my feet, in other words. What brought all this to an end was a call from Harold Oblowski not more than 3 days after Deborah's call. It was storming outside, a vicious snow changing over to sleet event that proved to be the last and biggest blast of the winter. By mid-evening, the power would be off all over Derry, but when Harold called at 5 p.m., things were just getting cranked up. "I just had a very good conversation with your editor," Harold said. "A very enlightening, very energizing conversation. Just got off the phone, in fact." "Oh? Oh, indeed. There's a feeling at Putnam, Michael, that this latest book of yours may have a positive effect on your sales position in the market. It's very strong." "Yes," I said. "I'm taking it to the next level." "Huh?" "I'm just blabbing, Harold. Go on." "Well, Helen Nearing's a great lead character, and Skate is your best villain ever." I said nothing. Deborah raised the possibility of making Helen's Promise the opener of a three-book contract, a very lucrative three-book contract, all without any prompting from me. Three is one more than any publisher has wanted to commit to on your behalf up to now. I mentioned $9 million, $3 million per book, in other words, expecting her to laugh. But an agent has to start somewhere, and I always choose the highest ground I can find. I think I must have Roman military officers somewhere back in my family tree. Ethiopian rug merchants, more like it, I thought, but didn't say. I felt the way you do when the dentist has gone a little heavy on the Novocaine and flooded your lips and tongue, as well as your bad tooth and the patch of gum surrounding it. If I tried to talk, I'd probably only flap and spread spit. Harold was almost purring. A three-book contract for the new, mature Michael Noonan. Tall tickets, baby. This time I didn't feel like laughing. This time I felt like screaming. Harold went on, happy and oblivious. Harold didn't know the bookberry tree had died. Harold didn't know the new Michael Noonan had cataclysmic shortness of breath and projectile vomiting fits every time he tried to write. "You want to hear how she came back to me, Michael?" "Lay it on me." "She said, 'Well, nine's obviously high, but it's as good a place to start as any. We feel this new book is a big step forward for him. This is extraordinary. Extraordinary! Now, I haven't given anything away. Wanted to talk to you first, of course, but I think we're looking at 7.5 minimum. In fact, no.'" He paused a moment, long enough for me to realize I was gripping the phone so hard it hurt my hand. I had to make a conscious effort to relax my grip. "Mike, if you'll just hear me out..." "I don't need to hear you out. I don't want to talk about a new contract." "Pardon me for disagreeing, but there'll never be a better time. Think about it, for Christ's sakes. We're talking top dollar here. If you wait until after Helen's Promise is published, I can't guarantee that the same offer..." "I know you can't," I said. "I don't want guarantees. I don't want offers. I don't want to talk contract." "You don't need to shout, Mike. I can hear you." Had I been shouting? Yes, I suppose I had been. "Are you dissatisfied with Putnam's? I think Deborah would be very distressed to hear that. I also think Phyllis Grant would do damn near anything to address any concerns you might have." "Are you sleeping with Deborah, Harold?" I thought. And all at once, it seemed like the most logical idea in the world, that dumpy, 50-ish, balding little Harold Oblowski was making it with my blonde, aristocratic, Smith-educated editor. "Are you sleeping with her? Do you talk about my future while you're lying in bed together in a room at the Plaza? Are the pair of you trying to figure out how many golden eggs you can get out of this tired old goose before you finally wring its neck and turn it into pâté? Is that what you're up to?" "Harold, I can't talk about this now, and I won't talk about this now." "What's wrong? Why are you so upset? I thought you'd be pleased. Hell, I thought you'd be over the fucking moon." "There's nothing wrong. It's just a bad time for me to talk long-term contract. You'll have to pardon me, Harold. I have something coming out of the oven." "Can we at least discuss this next week?" "No," I said, and hung up. I think it was the first time in my adult life that I hung up on someone who wasn't a telephone salesman. I had nothing coming out of the oven, of course, and I was too upset to even think about putting something in. I went into the living room instead, poured myself a short whiskey, and sat down in front of the TV. I sat there for almost 4 hours, looking at everything and seeing nothing. Outside, the storm continued cranking up. Tomorrow there would be trees down all over Derry, and the world would look like an ice sculpture. At 9:15, the power went out, came back on for 30 seconds or so, then went out and stayed out. I took this as a suggestion to stop thinking about Harold's useless contract and how Joe would have chortled at the idea of $9 million. I got up, unplugged the blacked-out TV so it wouldn't come blaring on at 2 in the morning. I needn't have worried. The power was off in Derry for nearly 2 days. And went upstairs. I dropped my clothes at the foot of the bed, crawled in without even bothering to brush my teeth, and was asleep in less than 5 minutes. I don't know how long after that it was that the nightmare came.